This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Smallpox, polio, rubella. Thanks to vaccines, these diseases and others have largely faded from our memory. Vaccination is an important arrow in medicine's quiver. It is also a controversial arrow. Think here of the qualms of parents over side effects of vaccines for pediatric diseases, and most recently, the debates over Gardasil, the vaccine to prevent cervical cancer. Turns out, vaccines have been controversial since their discovery. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at the history of vaccination in the United States. Our guest is journalist Arthur Allen. He's the author of Vaccine, the controversial story of medicine's greatest lifesaver. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Arthur Allen. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Arthur Allen is a former foreign correspondent for the Associated Press. He's also written for several other publications, other news agencies, including the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, and Salon. He writes the risk column for Slate. His book, Vaccine, the Controversial Story of Medicine's Greatest Lifesaver, is published by W.W. Norton. Listeners, we look forward to your telephone calls, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And let me mention that you'll find our guest, Arthur Allen, and his blog and more about the book Vaccine at the website www.vaccinecontroversy.com. Arthur Allen, good afternoon. Welcome.
It's a thrill to be here. Thank you so
much. It's
nice
to talk with you. The first part of your book deals with the origins of vaccines, and you open with a story of Cotton Mather. Tell us about the entry Mather made in his journal back on May 26th of 1721.
Yes, he was looking out of his bedroom, I guess, over the harbor, the Boston Harbor, and he was looking at a ship that had come in and carried smallpox from the east, from the Caribbean up to Boston, and there was a smallpox epidemic beginning. And he wrote, you know, smallpox is upon us. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to introduce something that can prevent it. And what he was doing was there was a process which at the time was known as inoculation, which involved taking pus from a smallpox blister and putting it in a jar and then taking some of it out and spreading it on the skin of a patient and scratching it in with a lancet. And he convinced Zabdiel Boylston, who was a surgeon in Boston, very primitive profession at the time, to start doing this in Boston. And he had read about it in some London scientific journals, and also he had heard about it, that is, Cotton Mather had heard about it, from a slave named Onesimus who had been given to him. And in those days, when you had a slave, you always wanted to know if they'd had smallpox, because if they had, it meant that they would not be infected when smallpox swept through the next time, as it always did, especially in big cities in the 18th century. There were recurrent waves of smallpox. And they could also take care of people who got sick, so that was an added value. And Onesimus looked at Mather and said, well, yet the answer is yes and no. And he explained that in his village in what is now Libya, people had been scarified with smallpox. That is, they were inoculated, as children. And so he had been inoculated, and he explained this to Mather, who found it very interesting. And then when Mather read about it in these journals, he decided that this was something worth trying.
Was it practiced in Europe at this point?
I'm sorry?
Was it practiced in Europe at this point?
Yes, and so it was being introduced simultaneously in Europe, and there it was brought over by a kind of blue stocking named, who's a very famous woman named Lady Montague, whose husband had been the British ambassador to the Turkish Empire, and in Constantinople she had seen older women doing this practice, and she brought it back to London. And so it was kind of introduced simultaneously. They didn't know that it had been used. I think they were mutually ignorant of what was going on during this epidemic. Although I think the epidemic was related. It was something that was sweeping throughout sort of British colonies at the time.
Yeah, because if it had arrived on ship, arriving in Boston, it had to come from somewhere else.
Right, and now this was a terrifying event. You can imagine there was nothing to do but head for the hills up to then. I mean, there were treatments for smallpox that were really awful affairs, involved either getting you really, really hot by burying you under blankets or exposing you to frigid winds and ice, with the idea that one of these techniques would cause you to purge all of the ill humors, which was how they thought of disease in those days. They didn't do any good, and the mortality from smallpox usually was 20-30%. But Mather, of course, at this time was a very controversial figure in Boston. He'd been seen as having kind of been a fellow traveler of the Salem witch trial. He had written that it was for a while he supported it and then later backed off. But at his congregation was shrinking, and he was always kind of on the make. Mather was always looking for a way to get himself some celebrity. People were terrified by this idea that he brought over, because the idea that you would give someone smallpox to prevent smallpox didn't make any sense. It had never been tried anywhere that anyone knew about, and all the doctors were against it.
And also, you said that the pious response to something like this was to accept its divine judgment as an opportunity for repentance.
That's right. I mean, Mather himself is somewhat contradictory in this regard, because he had written about smallpox earlier that, you know, when you see the boils appear on your skin, you know that it's a time to, you know, surrender to God and you know, ask him for forgiveness or ask for his divine, you know, judgment on you, because there's nothing you can be done. So, but when he introduced vaccination, his attitude was, well, this is something that God has made available to us, and so it would be a sin not to try it. It was a gift of a kind God. So there's a contradiction there, and he convinced most of the clergy around him that it was a good idea. And so in Boston, most of the opposition was organized by doctors rather than clergy. In England, actually, the opposite happened. The doctors became fascinated by it and bought into it pretty much, although there was also opposition there. But the clergy felt that, yes, this was contravening God's path, God would do what he wanted, that diseases were the tools of an angry God.
And why would doctors be resistant?
Well, doctors weren't familiar with this idea, and the dominant idea for treating smallpox at the time, it was not based on the idea that it was an infectious disease, and certainly no one was familiar with the idea that you would battle an infectious disease by bolstering the immune system, which is what vaccines do. So the idea was that doctors felt that there was this crazy preacher poaching on their turf, on their profession. He should stick to matters of God. And they also felt that vaccination would introduce all kinds of evil things to the body. And then there were the Malthusians, the, you know, lifeboat theory, which was that, you know, Malthus, who was alive at this time, felt that smallpox, I think the quote was something like, smallpox is one of the channels that God uses to clear out, you know, the surplus population, words to that effect. A lot of the Tories in England were against vaccination, because they felt that it would be better to have a disease that killed as many poor people as possible.
And what was the public response to the idea of inoculation?
Well, it was initially very skeptical and horrified. In fact, someone threw a firebomb through Cotton Mather's window and said, "I'll inoculate you with this." And in large part, that over time, as inoculation became a more common practice, and even in Boston, there was a study actually done of the outbreak and of the effect of vaccination, and it showed that only about 3% of the people who were vaccinated died, and that was compared to 20 or 30% who died, when they were infected by smallpox the normal way. So it did actually catch on pretty quick, and as I said, the Royal Society in London supported it, and there were papers about it. And then as techniques were introduced that allowed it to involve slightly less blood drawing and so on, it caught on. And it eventually, Jefferson, Washington, many of our leaders were vaccinated this way. Benjamin Franklin became a big proponent of it eventually. Smallpox was a real ever-present danger in those days.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Arthur Allen, author of Vaccine, the controversial story of medicine's greatest lifesaver. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now who's waiting for us in Kankakee on line 4. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm talking about the uterine cancer vaccination. As I understand that vaccination, it guards women against getting uterine cancer. But why only give the vaccination to women when obviously it's a transmitted disease? Why wouldn't you give it to both women and men?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's the cervical cancer vaccine, I think, is what you're talking about. The one made by Merck is called Gardasil. Well, the reason initially that it's being recommended for women is that it's really only been tested very much in women. And the reason it's only been tested very much is because what they're trying to measure in this vaccine is whether it causes precancerous growths that'll lead to cervical cancer. So in the study, they inject, half the group with vaccine and the other half doesn't get anything. And they look after a period of years how many of these women are developing precancerous growths. With men, you wouldn't see any precancerous growths. So it's a little trickier to test whether it's working in men. You can test it by seeing whether they have antibodies. And I think eventually, and I know that the manufacturer eventually wants to have it given to men as well as women, but it's a little trickier to check whether it's working. And so it's just a separate procedure. So the first idea was that I think it would be easier to, since this cancer doesn't affect men significantly, although men can get penile cancers and a few things like that from this same virus, but the mortality and the sickness in men from this virus is much lower than women, so they're targeting it, both the research and the selling of the vaccine, to women at this point. But you're right. Eventually, to prevent transmission, the optimal thing would be to give it to both.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. It strikes me, thinking about Gardasil and thinking about the history of vaccines, that the debates over this vaccine, Gardasil, are complex. They involve safety, the cost of the vaccine, and morality. Do the debates that we have today over vaccines, do they mirror past debates over vaccines?
Yes and no. I mean, they do in the sense that there's always a kind of latent mistrust of vaccination, which goes back to the very early days of it, which has to do with why should I stick this foreign substance in my body when I'm healthy? You know,
mm-hmm.
we are willing to put up with all kinds of horrible medicines when we're sick. I mean, chemotherapy is not a pleasant experience with tremendous side effects, or even antibiotics have a much higher rate of side effects than vaccines do. But you take them when you're sick, so you're willing to put up with it. And with vaccines, there's always this feeling. And in the case of Gardasil, the feeling is my girl is 10 or 11 or 12 years old. She's not going to be exposed to this virus. And somehow there's a feeling that if you expose them to this vaccine, it's almost as if you're forcing them to expose themselves to the virus, to have sexual intercourse, which of course isn't true, and there are some reasons for vaccinating young girls, which I can go into. But so, yes, and there's always been a feeling that the drug companies, you know, are foisting something on us that we don't need. And but I guess what's new is this vaccine is sort of complex. In my opinion, it's a little early to be making it mandatory. I think that they should wait for a few years because it's a new vaccine. And so some of the opposition, I think, is justified and is quite rational in that people are saying this vaccine was only licensed 6 months ago. To me, it looks like a very good vaccine, by the way, but it hasn't been tested on more than about 1,500 young girls in addition to, I think, 20,000 women. So people are opposed to making it mandatory until it's been around longer.
Yeah. How much longer do you think it would need to be around before we could say, okay, it's...
Yeah. You know. Well, that's always a bit of a tough question, but I would say, you know, at least a couple of years. And the logic of it is just so that, you know, I know lots of people who are getting their daughters vaccinated right away. I mean, it looks like a good vaccine, and it's the kind of thing that could prevent a lot of worry in the future. I mean, women get cervical exams, pap smears, in order to prevent this cancer as well. But hopefully, if this vaccine works the way they think it's going to work, women will have fewer unusual or suspicious findings when they get pap smears. So it'll prevent cancer, but even in people who are going to the doctor enough to prevent cancer other ways, it should prevent some worry. So anyway, I think there'll be enough people getting vaccinated with this vaccine in the next few years to build up sort of the database to be able to say, oh, this vaccine looks safe, you know.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you kind of just touched upon a point that I think is being made here. They're using, in my opinion, young girls for guinea pigs to develop their research. And I'm really quite upset about this vaccine, because my understanding is that in only 3% of cases where women have this virus, cancer actually develops in only 3% of the cases. And I'd be interested to know what you know about that. And I haven't read your book. Don't know anything mm-hmm. about you, so I'm just calling off the fly here.
Sure.
And,
it's great.
I just understood that Merck has had to withdraw their advertising for this vaccine because of the uproar, and I look forward to hearing what you say.
Yeah, well, guinea pigs is kind of a loaded word. I mean, I think this vaccine went through the proper, you know, testing. I mean, 20,000 people for a product like this is a good, solid number. When I say that, I mean, in a sense, we're all guinea pigs in that when we try a new drug, you know, it's only been tested a certain amount, and so drugs tend to, you know, side effects tend to turn up in drugs when they've been out there long enough. That's true of anything. But I don't think that it's been improper for Merck. You know, I don't think Merck was introducing it improperly. I just think that they've been pushing it too hard, And so in that sense, they provoke the kind of fears that you're expressing, because it's like, you know, they're pushing it, they're doing advertising on TV, direct to consumers, and the public health people, who are the people who decide when a vaccine is going to be mandatory or not, they and state legislatures decide. They're not in favor of making this mandatory yet. And so most of them were taken by surprise by this lobbying campaign, in which Merck sort of enrolled some women's groups, you know, which are, as far as I know, legitimate groups and who legitimately believe in the vaccine. But it does seem it's a little unseemly to be pushing it so hard. Now, in terms of the vaccine's value, it's I think 3% of women are infected with cancer-causing strains of this virus sometime in their life. And that's a lot. I mean, 3% is not a high chance on an individual level, but yeah, it's a lot. I mean, and viruses and bacteria that are less widespread than that, you know, we have vaccines against and we get vaccinated against, and we're happy to do it. So I think it's a, you know, this disease kills 4,000 American women a year, causes another, I forget the number, something like 10,000 cases of cancer a year. It's a good disease to try to prevent. So I think it's not a bad idea to have this vaccine out there. I just think it's being pushed a little too hard.
Yeah. It really is interesting that direct-to-consumer marketing has worked for so many other things, but apparently vaccine is not one of those things.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, that is really interesting. I mean, to me, vaccination really only, it's like a three-legged stool. And the three legs of it are sort of the drug companies, which historically have not made a lot of money on vaccines. And so they needed to be sort of convinced to get into the vaccine market and stay in the vaccine market. So, you know, we have to be willing to pay a fair amount of money for these new vaccines. And that means since vaccines, about half of the vaccines that are given to kids are bought by the government. Because you have to, if you're going to mandate a vaccine, you have to make it free to people who can't afford it. Otherwise, how can you tell a bunch of kids' parents, you kids can't go to school unless they're vaccinated if they can't afford the vaccine? So they have to pay for it. So it requires the buy-in of the public health authorities, the government, the public, you know, people in health, the government, have to say, well, yeah, this is a good vaccine. We want to protect our population against this. We're willing to pay for it. And the third leg is people, you know, the people who get the vaccines and their parents, if they're kids, who have to say, you know, this is worthwhile. This is a disease that you've convinced me is worth preventing. You know, if you lose the trust or the ability to function of any of those three legs inside this program, it collapses. And so what happened in this case is you only had one leg, really, or one and a half, maybe, which is, you know, half the public maybe was very enthusiastic about this vaccine. Public health was kind of saying, well, it looks like a good vaccine. Let's wait and see. And maybe we will mandate it in a few years.
Let's take some other calls. Next, we're going to go to Bloomington, Indiana, listener on line 4. Hi.
Hi. This vaccine is given on the assumption that the girls are going to have promiscuous sex. And if they are going to have promiscuous sex, then the human papillomavirus is not the only venereal disease that they need to fear. So if you encourage girls to have promiscuous sex, you are encouraging the venereal disease that is now, we have venereal disease that is endemic. One out of four of our young people have at least one active venereal disease. Anyone who is promiscuous, it doesn't matter. It's not if they are going to get a venereal disease. It's just a matter of how soon. So to give an injection, to give a vaccine that prevents one venereal disease seems to be, pretty counterproductive.
Actually, I think it's very productive, and I appreciate what you're saying. I think you're right. If people have promiscuous sex, they're likely to get all kinds of, you know, infectious diseases that way. I mean, yeah, there's plenty of things going around besides HPV. But you, if you give girls who are going to be promiscuous HPV before they have sex, then they won't get cervical cancer, and that's, or you know, they're less likely to. I mean, I do not think that this vaccine encourages girls to be promiscuous. And one other point I wanted to make is that it doesn't. Sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. This vaccine is. What was the first part of what he said? That it's.
It encourages girls to be promiscuous.
Oh, it encourages them. I know what you're saying. I mean, you don't have to be promiscuous to get HPV. I mean, it's, you know, it's when you consider that 80% of women who have sex in this country will be a carrier of an HPV strain. You know, most of those women are not promiscuous. It's circulating. This virus is so common. I mean, it's almost like the measles of your nether parts. I mean, it's going around. People get it. So I don't think you're saying that a girl is going to be promiscuous, that only someone who is going to be promiscuous would be served by getting this vaccine. I mean, I think it serves everyone, and it will help, you know, reduce the circulation of this virus. And that's, I just don't see the downside to that, provided that it's a safe vaccine. Of course, I also think that if parents, you know, feel strongly that doing this is encouraging their daughters to be promiscuous, or for whatever reason that they don't want to do it, they don't want to give their daughters this vaccine, you know, they should have the right to opt out. And in almost every state in this country, they will. So, you know, I think I disagree with the argument that it encourages promiscuity, but I also think that parents have the right to be the ultimate, you know, to opt out if they want to.
Let's. I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Some stories about the Salk vaccine. I saw an interview once with Jonas Salk where he said he couldn't have given out the polio vaccine the way they did, that from the time they got it to inoculating all the fourth graders in the country was like 6 months. And he was actually worried that he might have been wiping out an entire generation.
He was worried that he was going to wipe out...
If he was wrong about the safety of the vaccine, he was going to wipe out...
Right, because of the way they did it. Yeah, I mean, there were 2 million kids involved in this trial, in the trial of the polio, the Salk polio vaccine. It was a massive undertaking. You know, there were millions of Americans who gave money to the March of Dimes, and there were hundreds of thousands of volunteers, and they called the kids who took part in it, you know, pioneers. They didn't call them test subjects, you know. I mean, you talk about guinea pigs. They were guinea pigs, but, of course, they were willing guinea pigs because the risk-benefit equation that everybody was making at the time was much different than it is today, because polio was staring you in the face in the early, you know, in the 1950s in this country. It was a terrible, terrible disease that you could see. And not only killed people, but left them crippled, put them in iron lungs for years, left them in wheelchairs for their entire lives. So, yeah, I mean, no one does trials like that anymore, although it should be said that in some ways the Salk vaccine trial was very innovative in that there was a blinded part of the trial. The doctors didn't know whether they were giving kids vaccine or salt water. And that was pretty new innovation at the time. It had only been done on that scale in Britain when they were testing some new antibiotics. So it was both, you know, sort of a symbol of the way we used to do things and also a real step into the future.
What was the time period? Within a short time period, though, before they did the test, I guess? They tested everybody in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think basically, yeah, they invited people were vaccinated at schools, and it all happened roughly in the same time. You know, that this vaccine was shipped out and kids were vaccinated. Yeah, I guess if he had blown it. And there's a kind of an interesting little sidelight from it, which is considering this, you know, there's been this controversy over thimerosal, which is a mercury-containing preservative mm-hmm. that was in a lot of vaccines until recently. And Salk didn't want to use thimerosal in the polio vaccine because he didn't think it would work, and he was right. It ended up damaging the vaccine, made it less effective. But they forced him to use it in a lot of the vaccine because they were worried that the polio was going to revert to virulence and that, yeah, he'd be injecting the whole country with this vaccine that would give them polio. So there's a theory going out there. Some scientists believe this, that the reason that Salk's vaccine trial didn't result in a lot of cases of polio is that there was thimerosal in the vaccine, which, if people out there are listening know anything about the thimerosal controversy, it's kind of ironic. But anyway.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and we can probably come back to that topic
Sure. Here
if we have time. But we've got some other listeners who would like to talk with you. Next, we're going to go to a caller in Champaign on line 2. You're on the air with Arthur Allen. Hi. Line 2?
Hello, yes, hi.
Yeah, hi.
I didn't catch the beginning of the program, so I hope I'm not asking a question that's already been addressed. But the vaccination, I can see the benefits for cancer in women. But how come the a vaccine hasn't been developed for men, or does the way the virus work, it's just not as effective?
Yeah, I mean, I did explain this to an earlier caller that it could well be given to men because, as you say, I mean, the virus is carried by men as much as it is by women. The reason it hasn't been given now is because in the vaccine trials the virus isn't as harmful to men in terms of the
right.
number of cancers that it causes. So they wanted to test it on women to see if it prevented these cancers from developing. So the focus in the research has been looking at women rather than men.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
You're welcome. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a little concerned about stigmatizing cervical cancer as a venereal disease. There are documented cases of women, many of them very, very elderly women, some of them nuns in convents, who have developed cervical cancer, not because of any kind of sexual intercourse, but for other sorts of reasons. Very sloppy hygiene, for instance, even in a doctor's office where a rather unhygienic pap smear was taken. There are other ways, and it doesn't necessarily mean that, A, anyone is promiscuous, B, that it is invariably transmitted by sexual means.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not familiar with that. I mean, I certainly would believe that there are cases like that that would be kind of outliers. I mean, I think...
I'm not saying that they're not outliers, of
right,
course.
Right.
Of course.
But
I'm
of
simply
course, that's
saying
true.
That
I mean,
it's not invariable.
Right. Well, that's true of so many, you know, diseases like this that, I mean,
yes.
Hepatitis B,
right.
People often think of as being transmitted through sex or through intravenous drug use and so on, but it also can be spread from a mother to a child, and also apparently rarely, you know, kids biting each other or a kid scraping their leg against a thorn bush and then some other kid, you know, cutting their, you know, so that kind of thing happens. But
okay.
Primarily, and you know, the it is sexually transmitted.
Of course. Okay, I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments invited here on the Afternoon Magazine. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with our guest, Arthur Allen, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is the author of Vaccine, the Controversial Story of Medicine's Greatest Lifesaver. Well, let's talk about thimerosal and the concerns of some that there's a link to autism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this was a story that started in 1999. The CDC noticed that the amount of this preservative in vaccines that children were receiving, you know, routinely in their first 2 years was potentially higher than the exposure that was recommended by the EPA. There are a lot of caveats that go into that. The EPA limits were based on a study in Denmark that involved women who'd eaten whale meat and had gotten methyl mercury, ingested methyl mercury and passed it along to their fetuses. But the thimerosal contains ethyl mercury, which is a different compound, although it's related. But anyway, as a preventive measure, the CDC asked the drug companies to take thimerosal preservatives out of the vaccines, and they started doing that that year. And then by early 2002, there really wasn't any thimerosal substantially in any of the routine vaccinations except for flu, which is only, it was given to kids sometimes between 6 months and a year, but it was only maybe 10 or 20 or 30% of children were getting it. So it didn't significantly increase the amount of mercury that a child was being exposed to. So the question is, did autism, you know, autism diagnoses were growing throughout the 90s all around the country. And the 90s is when these new vaccines with thimerosal were introduced. And so people were looking at these two charts, you know, the needles going up on autism, the needles going up on the amount of thimerosal in vaccines. So they took the thimerosal out of the vaccines, and the number of cases of autism keeps going up because they aren't related. And I was one who, for a while, believed that there could be a link, but I've been convinced by the evidence that there isn't. And the reason is, if you look at these, you know, the collections of data, and you look at the number of children who are being diagnosed with autism, it continues to be very high, even in children who are not getting vaccines that have that had any thimerosal at all. So there's no connection. But I do think it was a good idea to take the mercury out of these vaccines because cumulatively it isn't good to expose infants or anybody else to organic mercury.
Yeah. For folks who are interested in autism and the increase in diagnoses, you might want to go back to the show we did yesterday at this time on the 12th of March of 2007. My guest was Roy Richard Grinker, who is an anthropologist and the author of Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism. He has a daughter with autism. And he says, you know, you got to look at how the American Psychiatric Association has worked the definition and how we're just more aware of autism.
Right.
And he sees it as a very good thing that we're, because we're getting kids into the services that they need.
Right. They're getting the attention and they're getting help. And I think his book has the best explanation of this thing that I've seen anywhere.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, sir. I wanted to ask a question getting back to the risk-benefit analysis of the Gardasil vaccine, specifically because, first off, cervical cancer is eminently treatable when it does occur. And second off, because I have heard and seen some websites where they suggest that the vaccine was actually tested improperly, that the control drug actually contained aluminum. So in comparing the Gardasil side effects with the quote-unquote non-reactive control drug, which actually contained aluminum, that the side effects would actually seem to be reduced. It would be a low estimate of side effects. I'd like you to speak about the cost-benefit analysis on those 2 points, and I will log off because my phone is dying. Thank you.
Okay.
I don't agree with that analysis of the. I mean, I think the vaccine trial was perfectly good. I mean, the reason the aluminum is given is because that's a normal part of the adjuvant that's contained in vaccines, and so it's actually by giving it, they're showing that this they're providing, and you know, people are getting vaccinated with other vaccines, so I don't consider that a bad sort of control element. I think, you know, time will tell. I mean, these things, when vaccines go bad, you know, I think we find out sooner rather than later. And so I'm not really concerned about that. I think the trial was a good trial. I don't think anything fishy was done. I mean, you can always argue with protocols for these things, but I don't think that there was any kind of concerted effort to make the vaccine look better or look like it had fewer side effects. To me, the side effect profile that, you know, I read it, I went to the FDA meeting and I looked all over all of the data where they discussed it, and it didn't look suspicious to me, and it didn't look like anything other than what you sort of see with your garden variety of drug. But as I said, you know, 20,000 is a lot for a trial, but it isn't a lot on a population scale in terms of finding unusual events. So if there's some weird thing that this vaccine causes, and I'm not saying it does, but that will take longer to find.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Good afternoon. I have two main questions, and one is, can the virus that you were talking about, the
HPV?
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yes.
human papillomavirus. Can that be transmitted via men who come in? Okay. So, you know, the caller who said, oh, we don't want our girls to be promiscuous,
right.
Even girls and women who are not promiscuous can be infected by a single male partner who may have been carrying it from contact with another woman.
Right.
And secondly, when you talked about only half the population in America is for this vaccine, I'm very curious as to whether there is a gender split, or if you look at just gender, who is for it and who is against it.
Yeah, when I said half, I was just talking completely out of my hat. I mean, I don't know of any polls. I guess what I was just saying is that there will be a lot of people who will get the vaccine, and as a result of getting it, they'll provide data on the effects of it. That's all I was trying to say. I don't know. That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, I think
if men are against it, well, that's one thing. If women are against it, that's something else.
Yeah. I don't think there is a strong gender thing. I think most people, despite all the publicity, don't really understand. Rarely do people really get what these vaccines are about. And that's part of the argument for making them mandatory, is that it kind of sharpens your attention. I mean, if you just don't get it because you don't bother, because you don't really know what the disease is and you don't really know what the benefit of it is, you know, unless it's mandated, you're not going to get it. You're not going to get your daughter vaccinated in this case. But if you are told to get it, I mean, most people will sort of just do what their doctor tells them or do what the school tells them. The people who are concerned about it will look into it and really do some research, and then I would say most of them will say, eventually, I'm talking about 3, 4, or 5 years from now, most of them will say, okay, this is good vaccine. Some will say, I don't know, I don't like vaccines, and I don't want my daughter getting this. I mean, that's fine. I mean, you know, we're not in a dictatorship. I don't, you know, we can't ask people to do what they don't want to, but I do think it's better to have an opt-out than an opt-in with a lot of vaccination programs.
And let's take one last call. We'll have to be quick. Line one, Urbana, hi.
Hi, this is a question about the promotion lead-in that WILO was giving about the role of Jenner.
Yes.
In the lead-in, they were saying that Jenner gave somebody smallpox and thereby prevented it. I understood that he gave them cowpox.
Yeah, it's easy to misunderstand that. I mean, Cotton Mather gave people smallpox, or the doctor that he hired to do it. Jenner, you're perfectly right, gave people cowpox, and he had noticed that milkmaids often didn't get smallpox, and it seemed to be because they were exposed to cows that had cowpox. So he was the first one to actually do an experiment where he exposed some kids, including his own son, to cowpox, and then exposed them to smallpox a couple weeks later, and they didn't get sick. And that was in 1798 that his paper was published, and that was really the modern smallpox vaccination the same one that was used, you know, a variety of it basically, but the same principle for the next almost 200 years, and it wiped out smallpox.
Yeah.
And that's why it was called vaccination rather than
exactly, because it came from vacca, V-A-C-C-A, the Latin word for cow.
And, you know, that's yours truly's fault, because I wasn't as careful with my promotional material yesterday.
Well,
as I should have been.
It's confusing. It's a lot of different.
So that's why today I started with Cotton Mather.
Right.
So
that's right.
Okay, very good. Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Arthur Allen, thank you very much for talking with us this
afternoon. Thank you so much for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Arthur Allen is the author of Vaccine, The Controversial Story of Medicine's Greatest Lifesaver. The book is published by Norton. You'll find our guest, Arthur Allen, and his blog and more on the book Vaccine at www.vaccinecontroversy.com.